Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Stoma for Life, the Bowel Cancer Awareness and Life as an Ostomate radio show and podcast. Your host, Raffaella, is here to debunk myths, clear up misconceptions, and help you approach the subject that so many people are afraid to talk about in a positive manner. Listen in for a new perspective. Stoma for Life on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Stoma for Life here on UK Health Radio. Now, today I want to start the show with something that was brought to my attention last week when I myself went to see my consultant for my annual checkup. He pointed out that some countries have lowered the age for you to have a FIT test. Now, I'm talking about the fecal immunochemical test, also known as the FIT test or the home testing kit. Now, here in the UK, it is common to have a screening done from the age of 60 to 75, but they're actually gradually extending this age range from 54 upwards, inviting you to take part in the testing every 2 years. Now, my consultant and I agreed that testing should be done much sooner because the age of people that are diagnosed with bowel cancer is not only increasing, but the patients are often much younger. Today, I've invited somebody that can certainly relate to this. Mohammed Samad was only 37 when he was diagnosed with bowel cancer. Everyone from the doctors to the nurses to the consultants would say something like, "But you're so young," and he wouldn't have anything to say back. He would actually take it as an insult, as it suggests to him that he might have perhaps done something wrong to be there. Now, in fact, he sees this as a blessing that he was so young, because if he had been older, he might not have survived with all that he had to go through. Here to share his story today is Mohammed Samad, who is a blogger dedicated to providing information about his experience as a cancer survivor and as a disabled person on social media. You can find his blog on his website, coloncancerandme.co.uk. Welcome to the show, Mohammed.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to speak to you. Now, as I suggested, you were only 37 when you were diagnosed. Could you perhaps take us back to that time?
Yeah, it was in 2021 when I was diagnosed with bowel cancer in the May, but I started experiencing issues back in October. Where I woke up one morning, went downstairs to make my cup of coffee, and whilst I was waiting for the kettle to boil, I could feel these sharp stabbing pains in the lower part of my abdomen. And it was so intense that it knocked me to the floor, but it only lasted a matter of seconds. So by the time it came and the same time it went, and I generally just carried on with my day, believing that it was nothing more than maybe a cramp or indigestion. It was during the time of the Eat Out to Help Out scheme. So I thought to myself, maybe I had overindulged in that scheme and I should get back onto eating healthy and back into the fitness regime. And during this time, my father had fallen ill and sadly passed away in the February of 2021 due to COVID. Okay. So it was a difficult year for myself and my family.
Absolutely. So yes, so you had the pain. Did you pursue it from there?
So the pains didn't return until the month after. Oh. So in the November, mm-hmm. The stabbing pains became more intense. I felt mm-hmm. bloated, constipated, fatigued. And prior to that, I was generally someone who took his health very seriously, in the sense that I was eating healthy, I was making my morning shakes full of all the greens, all the nutrients, taking my supplements. I was going to the gym, I was working out. I could honestly say that I was in the best shape of my life then. And I had two young, energetic children who would love to be outdoors as I did. So any excuse would be out running around, playing sports, be it basketball, football, cricket. So we were always a very kind of high energy, healthy family. So when those symptoms appeared, it was quite concerning as to say that, well, no, this isn't me. This isn't how I should feel. And, you know, in the new year, my family kind of pushed me to go see a doctor. And that was the first time I went to see them at my local GP surgery. On the initial consultation with my GP, they said that it was due to stress, and I was given laxatives, and it was 4 weeks worth. I had to take a morning and evening, and they said if it doesn't clear up by then, you should come back. And then my pains became more intense, the symptoms worsened, so I went back in 4 weeks, saw a different doctor who said to me that it was IBS. Both doctors physically examined me for where the stabbing pains were. By the second occasion where I saw that GP, where I mentioned to him that where the stabbing pains were occurring, I could feel a lump inside.
Wow, you actually felt it.
Yeah, I could feel it internally, and I would constantly like press on it. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you see Friends or watch Friends, but remember Joey had a hernia,
yes,
and he slips his hand,
yes,
down his trousers and pushes, yes, on that lump. That was me. I was kind of
okay,
sitting in a way where I was trying to push it back because that was the only place where I could feel comfort.
Wow.
But I was in agony at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But the GP said at that stage he couldn't feel the lump, and mm-hmm. it could just be a blockage that just needs to be forced through with a more laxatives. So I was taking Buscopan, more laxatives. Within about 2 weeks, I was, yeah, as I mentioned, in agony. Nothing was working. And it was really my father's death that kind of put out this red light to say something's not right here. You need attention. You need to see someone and get this sorted, because it could well be serious. And at that point, I sat down with the same doctor and I said to him that, you know, what you're offering me hasn't helped. And I've done my own research on IBS, and many of the symptoms are the same, but there's still this lump that I can feel, which is unaccounted for.
Mm-hmm.
So can we not do some form of tests to try and eliminate what it potentially could be? And if we go through a process and I continue taking the IBS treatment and it works, then I'll let you know. But at the moment, just throwing stuff at me in the hope that something will stick. And he kind of pushed back and goes, no, it's IBS. I'm confident on that. Just continue taking the medication. And I had to really dig in my heels and go, no, I'm not leaving until you can offer me some tests, a blood test maybe, as to try and figure out what it could be, what it could not be. Because there were known unknowns that he was kind of figuring out, and there was these unknowns that we really needed to push home as to what it could be. And at that point, the blood test came back 2 days after, and it showed a very high level of inflammation in my system. So the doctor asked me to go do another test, a blood test, and he also asked for a stool sample.
Mm-hmm. So that's the FIT test that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important, because, and I'll highlight why that is, because the blood test again came back, high levels of inflammation. He said to me, right, we'll need to send you to the local hospital and we'll put you in as an emergency outpatient, because it does need that, it does warrant that attention. So I went to this.
Sorry, because of the high markers that you had in the blood test.
That's right. Yeah, okay. Correct.
Yes.
So when I went to Lister Hospital in Stevenage, in the A&E ward, saw another doctor who did a blood test, and she confirmed to me that it was an IBS, and I would need a colonoscopy. They were still waiting on the stool sample to come back. But by the time I got to the opportunity of seeing a consultant, the stool sample came back. And at this point, the chat was, you know, pleasant, very nice, attentive. And he sat me down and I asked him, you know, everyone's saying to me that you've got high levels of inflammation, but what exactly does that mean? I don't understand what it is that's so concerning. And he then sat down, read the report, and said to me, "You poor sod," and continued to say, "With regards to your stool test, this is the most important test. It shows inflammation to warrant kind of an urgent conversation that we're having right now and a colonoscopy, which will follow." So the stool sample stated to him that we need to do it as an emergency colonoscopy. He explained that with regards to inflammation, it's measured in units. So if an individual, a healthy individual, will have normally between 0 to 20, you know, normally inflammation is fine. That's absolutely okay. Anything up to 200 is usually treated as like a common cold or a flu, maybe a virus, which your body could normally fight off, but they may prescribe you antibiotics to help you along the way. But he said my markers were over 2,000 units. And so therefore, we need to get you into theatre and have a look inside you as to what's happening. So the colonoscopy for your viewers is essentially a camera that goes up your rear, your anus, and then through your bowel, and they can see everything that's inside of it. As we sat down and we went through the results, he said to me that it's more than likely that it would just be Crohn's, which, you know, it can be manageable, but there's no kind of treatment as such to cure it. But we can delve into that after the colonoscopy. So I went in, took the laxatives, which is awful. You know, you drink about a litre of this concoction, and it's I had a lemon flavoured one, which was sickening, and you know, quite violent as well in terms of how it kind of just flushes out everything within your system. And so when I turned up to the colonoscopy, as I was still burping, I could taste this really diluted lemon fizz in the back of my throat. Horrible. I could see you swallowing, as to say you could taste it yourself. It was it was awful. But got under the camera, went around, and as he came round to the point of where I could feel that lump, those stabbing pains, they just grew so intense that before it was kind of being stabbed inwards, and then now it's being stabbed outwards from where the lump was, as if it was trying to force itself out through my abdomen. And I was begging him to stop. I said, "Stop, stop, stop." And the nurses was kind of pinning me down, saying, "You know, just breathe, just breathe. You're okay. You shouldn't be feeling anything. You've been given local anesthetic." And I was like, no, something's not right. Please, I beg of you." But the consultant just dosed me with anesthetic. I was out, and I woke up in this room with a nurse calling my name. She said to me, "Good, you're up. Let me go get the consultant, Dr. King, and he's going to speak with you." I couldn't make heads or tails as to what happened. And as he came in, he was followed by a nurse who was dressed in red. Well, I've never seen a red nurse before. And he sat me down and he said to me, he couldn't look me in the eye. He just looked at the floor and he said, "I'm really, really sorry. But where you were screaming, I could see something and I needed to get closer. But you were in so much pain, I had to dose you with the anesthetic and to calm you down." He said he saw a lump, and he believes that lump to be cancerous. He's taken samples. He's going to send those over to the center where they do cancer testing. And said, "I'm really, really sorry. Here's this lady. She's a cancer nurse. She's going to explain the next few steps." But as she was talking, he left the room, and as she was talking, my mind just went into this downward spiral as to go, how am I going to tell my mother, who had recently lost her life partner? How am I going to tell my kids, who had recently been introduced to this concept of death, to a loved one? And my father's death was the first significant death in our family. And they were so young, and it hit them so terribly. I just wanted the world to just swallow me up then and there. So it was an awful experience.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a roller coaster ride. I mean, that first IBS, they say to you, and then this doctor said, oh, perhaps Crohn's disease. And then you had the colonoscopy, which was absolutely horrific. And then maybe cancer. Yes. So, I mean, you were left really hanging there. Yeah, that must have been quite a shock. And for you to then obviously not just think of yourself, but of your loved ones as well. It's such a far reach, a diagnosis like that doesn't just affect you, it affects your whole family,
Absolutely. And, people don't really take that into account. It's not just the person who has cancer, it's their loved ones as well who suffer. When I returned home after being told they found a tumor, I thought to myself, look, I'll just hide it. I'll pretend it's nothing, and positive thinking, I'll get a cure and it will be fine and they'll be none the wiser. I remember walking towards my front door. My wife answered it, and I just fell to the floor sobbing, crying, and I just told her that it was cancer. And I mean, it feels like yesterday almost. When that happened.
But what I take from the story is you were persistent. You knew something was not right. I mean, you didn't take the doctor's word for it. You carried on. You went and investigated, and you were adamant on having it tested. And I think that is so key in anything, be it now in your case, bowel cancer, or in any diagnosis. You internally, you are living with yourself, you sort of know there's something wrong. And a diagnosis that didn't resonate with you made you look further, which I'm so pleased you did. I mean, it's a shame that you weren't offered a test right in the beginning, because a fit test might have led to some or other conclusion to what actually was going on. So, but I mean, that's all in the past now, and we can only go forward from here. But I'm just so pleased you actually listened to your intuition, because that's what I talk about most of the time, that my intuition also saved me, because if I hadn't been adamant, I also would not be here to tell the story, because people also just didn't think there was something wrong with me.
If you look at both of us, if I just take you, if I were to look at you crossing the road on the street, I would regard you as a healthy individual. All the GPs, the doctors, consultants, they looked at me. I was in, as I said, good shape at that time. I had quite a healthy glow as well. They said, you're young, you're healthy, you seem fine on the surface. Everything seems okay. Yeah. And your body is a unique and special piece of kit. It will send signals each time something's not right, be it a runny nose when you have a cold, or be it those stabbing pains, that lump that I could feel, cancer.
Absolutely. We are going to have a short commercial break, so we'll be returning shortly on Mohammed Samad's fascinating story.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Stoma for Life here on UK Health Radio. Now, we are joined by Mohammed Samad, who has just told us about his journey up to the point where he was diagnosed with bowel cancer. Now, I'm sure, like you said, the doctor left you with your cancer Macmillan nurse, I presume. And yes, you were left and you just received this diagnosis. I'm sure it didn't stop there. I mean, that's the beginning of the journey.
Yeah, that's the beginning of this roller coaster. Mm-hmm. So what happened after that is we waited for the results to come back. I was sent to the cancer centre in Rickmansworth, where I was handed over to a cancer specialist consultant. I got a phone call to say that the test results came back. However, it was inconclusive because all they could see was these dead cells. There was a layer there of which mm-hmm. my body was trying to attack this tumour and form that layer. And they said, right, we really need to get these results and we need to get them quickly to really start chemotherapy. If it is to be, you know, cancer, it may well be benign, but according to your symptoms, I don't believe that to be the case. So I had to go through a CT biopsy whereby they put me into a CT scanner. They map out where the tumour is and they drill down from the surface of the skin all the way down to the tumour, take chunks from the tumour out and then send that to the lab and they can get a conclusive result. And it was, in fact, cancer. So started that journey almost like in a blink of an eye. I was sent to a place where I had a PICC line fitted, where they could easily put the chemotherapy in rather than looking for a line. They put it into my neck.
It's like a port, isn't it?
That's it, yeah, a port, exactly mm-hmm. that. So it just sits on the surface of your skin and yeah. there's a tube that fits into the blood vessel to get around the system. It's a much more efficient way of providing people with chemotherapy. So I had that done and then, you know, my consultant was saying to me, right, you're young, you're healthy. What we should do is really try and offer you the highest dose of chemotherapy to get this mm-hmm. result quickly, because the tumor itself is about the size of a golf ball. The only mm-hmm. concern they have is it's pushing into the soft tissue area beside it. So we need to shrink it, bring mm-hmm. it back in. Mm-hmm. away from the tissue, and then we could go back cutting it and rejoining your bowel. So I had two rounds of chemotherapy. They treat you at the hospital, but you then continue your treatment at home. They give you a small canister attached to your PICC line, and that keeps going for a couple of days. Okay. And then you go back in mm-hmm. to the ward, and they remove the canister. And they provide you with a booster injection, which is supposed to kickstart your immune system. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that booster injection failed. And I caught what was quite a nasty infection called staph. That's a short-term word used for it. But essentially, staph, if yourself or your viewers are unsure about it or never heard about it, staph lives on everybody's skin. You and I have it. And whilst it's on the surface, it cannot do any harm. When it gets inside your system and inside your bloodstream, it is life-threatening. So what happened to me is it got into my right lung cavity and started tearing away at the lung wall.
Oh my!
I started forming these air pockets that were mm-hmm. Essentially blocking my airways. Mm-hmm. So I was finding it very difficult to breathe. I had a fever. I was delirious. And it also started eating away at my joints.
My gosh.
So I was rushed into hospital, blue lighted, and they pumped me full of antibiotics. I had three antibiotics, six times a day. I was kept in a separate room on a ward because of, you know, being high risk and having cancer. At the time, COVID was rampant and the hospital itself was in lockdown. And I remained there for a number of weeks. And I was being treated, and I got to a point where, you know, the infection was starting to come down and all the effects of it were wearing off. So they agreed to send me home. I would continue the treatment through community nurses that would come to me at my home to administer antibiotics. At the end of the course of antibiotics, they'll do a culture test, a blood culture test, let me know on the outcomes of it. So I had that all done, waiting for the test. My mum and my little sister came over to see me, and the phone rang, and it was hospital, and they gave me the results of that culture test, and they said the infection had started to come back. It started to worsen, so I need to go back in to hospital and go through this process once more of three antibiotics, six times a day. And whilst they were treating me, the infections would come down, the symptoms would wear off, I'll go home. In a matter of a day, the symptoms would worsen, I'll go back into hospital. And they couldn't make sense as to what was going on. And they were also concerned that because I hadn't been given chemotherapy, that the tumour was growing. And they got to a point where they were like, look, we're going to do a test here. We're going to take you off antibiotics, see what happens, and keep you in hospital to see if your symptoms worsen.
Yeah.
But they're confident that the staph infection itself has been rid of. So they did that. Matter of hours, delirium, fever, the amount of pain that I was in was intense. So they had to pass it on to a disciplinary board to figure out what was going on. So my consultant in the cancer centre was part of that conversation with heads of the department and consultants, surgeons. And what they believed had happened was that due to the intensity of the chemotherapy, my bowel had perforated and it was just spewing all these toxins into my system.
Wow.
So not only was I fighting the staph infection, I was fighting off this infection due to the perforation of my bowel. So they said that I would need emergency surgery to, because they can't put a plaster over it. They would need to go about carrying out a colostomy. So I had that done. They said, you know, I wasn't well enough to be operated on, and that was why they've delayed this in the hope that I would get better. But it's now or never. And my wife was called to say that we're going to take him in to surgery straight away to make your way. And, you know, I didn't know this at the time, but they said that there was a strong likeliness that I might not make it due to my poor health. So the surgery itself should have taken 4 hours. It took seven. I came out, I went into ICU, and then a couple of hours later, my heart rate elevated to the point I was going into cardiac arrest. So they brought me back into theatre. Fortunately, that didn't happen. The heart rate was able to come down. They'd obviously given me a sedative to go about reducing that heart rate. And I remained in ICU for quite some time before being moved into a isolated room where I woke up and I found this bag attached to my abdomen. I couldn't feel my legs. I felt very weak. And my consultant spoke to me and said that, you know, the tumour itself had grown to the size of a small water. It was pushing up on all my organs, hence why you're in so much pain. So we had to take it out, but the operation itself was a success. And we offered a bag, a stoma nurse will come and explain all of that. However, you've got these three tubes in the side of your neck. One is to administer fluids, the other painkillers, and another for antibiotics, because I'd contracted sepsis and pneumonia. And I would need to go about trying to fight that off to really just survive. So there was multiple incidences, for whatever the reason, maybe divine intervention, that got me through it.
Yeah, because you were fighting on so many fronts. Many fronts. And I mean, you, like you said, or like I said, you actually feel as if it's a blessing that you were so young, because if you might have been older, you might not have been strong enough. You know, you said going into this, you were a fit and healthy man. So that might have just been a blessing in disguise, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I do think it's one of the reasons why I was able to push through. But I do believe, you know, the attention that I got from the NHS in during a pandemic, mm-hmm. they're able to treat me and look after me and save my life. And I am very thankful to them. But I managed to fight off the pneumonia, managed to fight mm-hmm. off the sepsis. Mm-hmm. But I could feel this shooting pain up and down my right leg.
Yeah.
And it was so intense that, you know, I was given quite heavy painkillers at that time. I was on oxycodone through IV. And my surgeon said to me that it's more than likely because of the fact that I've been on a bed for several months now, and I'll just be able to walk it off. So yeah. I was sent to rehabilitation in mm-hmm. Boreham Wood. And there, whilst they were offering me physiotherapy to learn to walk again,
okay.
they noticed that, you know, I couldn't bear any weight on my right foot. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to send me back to hospital, but they said they were on lockdown. They can't take any more patients, yeah. but I would need to be treated there. But 6 months later, I was still in tremendous amounts of pain. Every time that my foot would, say if I was to put on a pair of socks or a piece of fabric would brush past it, it felt like this burning sensation. And I was forwarded to Queen's Hospital in London, the Centre of Neurology, where they conducted tests and did scans and all the rest of it. And their diagnosis was that I've got severe chronic nerve damage down my right leg.
Wow.
Numbness in both my feet.
My goodness.
I've got dropped foot in my right foot.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got medium nerve damage, my right arm and hand.
Okay.
They believe the hand is caused due to the chemotherapy, which does happen.
Okay.
It's a known side effect from the chemotherapy that mm-hmm. I was offered. And the leg, they believe it was to do with the fact that because the tumour was so large and it was mm-hmm. attached to the surrounding soft tissue,
yeah.
as they were cutting round that,
mm-hmm.
they damaged a nerve group, which caused this chronic pain.
Okay.
And the only way forward was to be treated with painkillers. So I'm on a whole host of different medication, from oxycodone, gabapentin, duloxetine, amitriptyline, and so on and so forth. It really is a cocktail that I need to take in the morning
yeah.
just to function through the day.
Absolutely. Are you still on that?
I am. I'll be on it for the rest of my life.
Oh, my.
And I've had other treatment as well. I've been offered a ketamine infusion, where, you know, normally you say ketamine, it's usually given to horses to put them down, but it was offered to me to help manage my pain, because
okay.
I'm still in a lot of pain, a lot of discomfort. You know, I was told that I would never walk again, but mm-hmm. I've managed to, you know, get around the house, as it were, mm-hmm. but for longer journeys, I have a mobility scooter.
Mm-hmm.
But the ketamine treatment, I'll go back to it, was unsuccessful. And okay. I'm waiting now on a consultation with my pain clinician
mm-hmm.
as to where we go with my treatment. Because at the moment, the treatment that I'm on isn't working. It gives me some comfort, but not much, because of its sedative effects.
Mm-hmm.
I spend most of my day battling with those side effects to try and get through a day where I can converse with people such as yourself and,
mm-hmm.
you know, attend my appointments and spend quality time with my children. But it has, you know, cancer really has taken so much away from me.
Absolutely. And I mean, we've covered the side effects now of chemotherapy and also of what happened during surgery. And we haven't even spoken about it, that you're actually living in an ostomy as well.
Yeah, that's right. So,
absolutely. That's sort of another thing to deal with. I mean, you know, regardless of, the trauma of going through surgery and everything else you've been through, you've got to deal with that as well.
Yeah, it was a shock to the system when I woke up and I saw this bag. I remember being spoken to about it during the initial consultation with my cancer consultant.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't dwell into that because they believed that because it was only a small golf ball size, it was easily treated and manageable. So having to get used to this, which I try and look at it to go, this bag saved my life. If it wasn't for this bag, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for the people that operated on me, I wouldn't be here. So I have a lot to be thankful for. And I kind of look at it with an optimistic point of view, but it is difficult. But the stoma itself has been much of a challenge, as you well know. It was explained to me how to change it and how to look after it. And I was given, you know, a bag with all the kit, the spray, the adhesive remover, the bin liners and all the rest of it. And I just had a horrid time with it to begin with, because the seals were awful. They were very inferior in terms of quality. They wouldn't adhere to my skin. They would leak constantly. The smell was awful from it.
Yeah.
And I really resented having a stoma. But little did I know, you know, I brought it to the attention of my stoma nurse, who was just saying, well, you know, that's just something you have to get used to and carry on. But I didn't realize that there were so many options out there for different bags from different suppliers,
absolutely,
different adhesive removers and products. And I'm now, if you don't mind me saying, it was a part of a Respond ambassador who provide and dispense products, you know, a consultation with them.
Yeah.
Within about 5 minutes, they were offering me different products, different sprays, different bags. I got introduced to aloe rings and vitamin D sprays and wipes and all sorts. And now I'm managing it. Okay. And, you know, I wouldn't go as far as enjoying it, but it's a far more pleasant experience.
And I mean, it just goes to show that not one size fits all. It's a trial and error, and what might work for one person will definitely not work for the other. And we are only as good as the products out there. I mean, I've said this countless of times because of me having found my bag, the way I handle it, I'm able to go about my life as you would say, as normal as possible. And without it, obviously, we wouldn't be able to. So I'm really glad you found your system and the provider that helps you with it. So on that note, we're going to have a short commercial break. And like I said, a big shout out to all the healthcare professionals and all the providers of ostomy bags.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Stoma for Life. Now, I must say, your story is one that really touches my heart because it is a roller coaster, and you have been through so much. And I mean, our listeners can't see you, but I see the most positive of people in front of me, and I am just so thankful that you were able to go through all of this and actually have the strength to come out on the other side. And you are taking it one day at a time. And I know your journey is obviously one that has still got a lot of, there's still a lot ahead of you, but I am sure you will find what absolutely works for you. And I can only commend you for absolutely listening to your inner voice and pursuing and being able to actually, walk your talk.
Thank you. Thank you. That's so kind. And likewise, I think you do an amazing job, and it's so important to tell people stories and listen to one another. You mentioned about, you know, we're only as good as the products that we have. I think one of the barriers that I certainly go about promoting is information. It can be difficult when you're first starting life with a stoma and the adjustment isn't easy. And it takes time to find those products and find those services that suit you and really find your own voice in a new world. Because It's different to the one that you had prior to the colostomy or ileostomy, depending on your on the procedure.
And I mean, obviously, we have wonderful stoma nurses that also come to our house and that we are dependent or can be dependent on and call any time of the day, which I myself have done already, you know, and it's sort of very comforting to know that there are people out there that that are there once you reach out to help you. And I find it very comforting also to speak to people that are going or are experiencing what I've gone through, you know, like also with doing the show. I think it's like you said, when you talk about it, it's also a form of healing. And if you know that there are others out there that are going through the same thing, it's also a huge comfort.
Yeah, there's a wonderful community out there on social media. I myself live in a small town in Hertfordshire. I know of no one else who has a stoma within my community. So I really looked out for people likewise to figure out, you know, how they manage their stomas, what products do they use, how life has affected them to be an ostomate. And yeah, this is wonderful, wonderful community on social media, on Instagram, who have been very welcoming and really opened doors of my eyes towards what's out there. So a lot of what I do, you know, like this interview, was very much reaching out to you and saying, you know, I love what you do and I would love to come on your show. Yeah. So it's about putting yourself out there, and that could be very daunting, as you well know, doing the radio show, you know, a few episodes in, and you're doing a magnificent job. And then when I write my blog, it does put yourself out there. There is a sense of vulnerability, but there's immense power and, you know, applause from the stoma community and the bowel cancer communities. There are some wonderful, wonderful people out there.
And I think it's just so important. And starting a radio show for me was also not on top of my game. I mean, I'd never in a million years thought I would do that. But I thought one has to raise awareness. And for me, that was the easiest way of doing it. And that's what the community or also the social media has played a very big influence on sharing it. I mean, years ago, this would not have been possible. You know, we would have had to go to a library to look up everything or, you know, be sort of left to our own devices because we wouldn't know about other people that would go through it. So it has helped a lot. And I know in our pre-interview, we chatted about the effect your life as an ostomate also had on your children. Like I said in the beginning, you know, a diagnosis doesn't just affect you as a single person, but for your whole family, it's an impact. I just want to touch on the story with your, I don't know if you want to share it with your daughter, with the school. I found that extremely interesting on how actually children perceive it and how they can grow from something like that.
They're very resilient. And, you know, I was naive to begin with, because I wanted to hide my diagnosis from them. And I was just telling them that I'm going to hospital just to have some treatment, some medicine, and, you know, everything's fine, it's all okay. And, you know, they were about 8 or 9 at the time, but they saw me, you know, go from this, in their eyes, their rock, their inspiration, the breadwinner, as it were, to becoming this frail, almost crippled individual. It shocked them, and they've had counselling. They still go through that through Isabel Hospice, who've been amazing. They've been a fantastic support. You know, and they themselves have gone about educating themselves about, you know, chemotherapy and ostomates and all the rest of it. And the story you mentioned about my daughter, it was sports day of the previous academic year, and I went there, t-shirt, shorts, the weather was lovely, and I got right in amongst the children. I was cheering my daughter and my son on, after they finished, a few of my daughter's friends came to her and said, "Was that your dad?" And it's like, yeah. So they finally saw who I was. They said, "What was underneath his shirt? We could see something on his tummy." And she explained, "Oh, that's a stoma." And she tried to explain it, and it was all a bit alien to them to go, not sure exactly what that means. So she asked me, could I take one of the bags in and do a presentation in school about stoma? I was like, yeah, absolutely. I would love to see it too. And so the teacher allocated time during the day where she did a PowerPoint slide and explained what a colostomy is, what a stoma is, how it affects them and me and our lives, and how it saved me. So, a huge applause for that. And, people even today recognize my stoma whenever I go into school, and ask me questions about it further to my daughter's explanation. So I just thought it was wonderful that she did something like that.
Absolutely. Well, I applaud her as well because it's, children are much more resilient than we actually give them credit for. And for your daughter to actually take that approach, I mean, not hide it, speak about it and explain it. And once I think the mystery is gone, it's actually much easier to live with and there is no hiding anymore. And so, I mean, that's just such a big topic out of the way, and you can just move forward. So I absolutely applaud your daughter for doing that, and also for the teachers to embrace that and give her the platform to explain. Because yes, well, I never knew what a stoma was, and only had to find out once I was actually dealt with the option. We're almost at the end of the show, but I do know that you still have so much to share. So I'm going to leave you to actually close the show with what your life looks like and what you are aiming to achieve through your diagnosis.
Oh, thank you, Rafaela. So there's two things that I just want to mention. I know that this will be live in December, but at this time of recording, we're part of what's called Movember. So Movember is a month in November. It's taken over November in the calendar year every year, and it's dedicated to raising awareness about men's health and encouraging men to take proactive steps towards improving their overall well-being. There's still that stigma in this day and age where men don't talk about their health issues, and unfortunately, that leads to them living with chronic and severe health matters. They leave things too late, beyond the point of such as bowel cancer. The earlier you get diagnosed, the more the likelihood of it being treated and managed are far higher, rather than leaving it to a later stage where unfortunately it goes beyond the point of being able to save your life. So it's important to have regular checkups. It's important for men to talk up about their issues, and it's important for men to really ask one another, "Are you okay? You looking well?" If it wasn't for my family to encourage me to, go to the doctors and ask questions and get a diagnosis, I probably wouldn't be here. So, yeah, there's a lot of information out there. Although it's only 1 month, I think we should really be encouraging men to talk about it throughout the year. And there's a whole host of information on my website regarding that as well. The other thing that I want to point out too is about the ethnic minority community when it comes to our treatment and how we're represented within the kind of medical research. A lot of what's out there, unfortunately, is either limited or it is outdated. And there's studies carried out by the British Nursing Journal that talks about, the lack of engagement with the ethnic minority groups and the lack of individuals coming forward to take part in tests and screens and getting a diagnosis, those experiences, even throughout COVID at the time, that, you know, my ethnic minority groups were at greater risk of dying, up to 50% compared to their Caucasian ethnicities. And the report itself, issued by the Public Health England, stated that there's been historical racism and poorer experiences of healthcare, as well as poorer living conditions when it comes to South Asian men who sadly passed away after contracting the coronavirus, which was, of course, one that was my father. So I do encourage the ethnic minorities to come forward and take part in testing, as well as using platforms like this and social media to talk about their health issues and remove that kind of cultural stigma that's associated with healthcare. So, you know, we need to be on a road to inclusivity, and representation in research is a key component of that. So, yeah, those are two issues that I'm really trying to push forward at this moment in time. And I'm hoping to engage with as many people as I can to deliver that message, because, you know, I could go back to the chemotherapy. You know, was that the right treatment for myself when it caused that rupture in my bowel? I do believe that that was the right course, but is there other treatments that could have been offered suited better for my kind of background? So, yeah, I want to create that safe space for discussions and sharing personal journeys, so it can help people from all backgrounds feel included and supported.
So your website is coloncancerandme.co.uk, where people can reach out and not only read your blog, but everything related to what you've just mentioned. So like I said, Mohammed, we've sadly come to the end of the show. Thank you so much for sharing your story and being an advocate for this very important topic. And as we've seen, cancer does not discriminate. Anybody can get it at any stage. And all that is actually, or the most important thing for us, is actually to listen to our bodies and pursue until we find and get the diagnosis that is actually that resonates with us, and where we know, okay, now something can be done and we can take it from there. So thank you so much for sharing your story. I wish you all the best going forward.
Thank you, Rafael. I really enjoyed the experience. And, you know, I've said to you that you're not only my friend, you're part of my family now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. Take care. All the best. Bye-bye.